This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And today's podcast is going to focus on the environment and some really substantial threats to our health from our ever-increasingly polluted environment. The book is called Sicker, Fatter, Poorer. The subtitle, The Urgent Threat of Hormone-Disrupting Chemicals to Our Health and Future and What We Can Do About It. Our guest is Dr. Leo Trasandi. He's an internationally renowned leader in children's environmental health. He's associate professor and vice chair for research at the Department of Pediatrics at NYU here in New York City. And he's been ubiquitous in the media, appearing on The Today Show, CNN, NPR, CBS News. He has also been quoted extensively in the New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times. He's a fellow New Yorker. And he's an MD and also is very involved in the field of public health. In fact, Dr. Trasandi, you're an MD, but you also enrolled at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Why is it that you pursued that dual-track career?
Well, I applied to medical school during the then-Clinton healthcare debate around universal healthcare, and I was getting asked all sorts of questions about my perspectives regarding the proposal, and there was a point where I stopped, and rather than give a rote answer or what might be expected, I asked the interviewer, well, what training do you get in health policy? And I don't think I got into that medical school because I don't think that response was well received.
Okay.
But suffice it to say that that got me thinking to the need to get more specific training given the rapidly evolving nature of health policy and its broader impact on all that we do in medicine. As much as we like to say we do so much with one patient at a time, There are many other factors that influence us on a broader scale. And so that was my signal to take a detour between my third and fourth year of medical school and get some training at the Kennedy School of Government, where I had the privilege of not being just exposed to health policy people, but to a broader array of people across perspectives and specialties. And that really infected me, if you will, or exposed me from an environmental perspective to the consequences of healthcare policy in people's lives. And that drove me to pursue healthcare policy as a broader career.
So in other words, instead of leveraging one patient after another in a single office encounter, you decided to have a broader impact on the health of perhaps thousands and millions with the work you're doing.
I wouldn't quite call myself an advocate, but I do appreciate why you're using that word. I think I would characterize myself as someone who's trying to have broader impact beyond what I can do in individual healthcare delivery. It's so important, but there are so many factors beyond our control, and so many of the decisions that influence those factors are done without a proper perspective of the scientific and medical reality. So it's important that we, as physicians, lend our voice to that kind of dialogue. It's not that others can't have that same influence on the dialogue. It's just that we generally don't weigh in the way we could.
Well, we're kindred spirits in that regard. And the book title is really intriguing. sicker, fatter, poorer. Where were you going with that concept? Because I think there's a lot of embedded meaning in those few words.
Let's start with the sicker part. So there's increasing evidence, especially over the past two decades, that some 1,000 synthetic chemicals commonly found in the environment influence the basic molecular signals our body uses for basic bodily functions, everything from body temperature, metabolism, salt, sugar, and even sex. The evidence is strongest for four categories of chemicals: the flame retardants used in electronics, furniture, pesticides, which are used in agriculture, bisphenols used in aluminum can linings and thermal paper receipts, and phthalates, which are used in personal care products, cosmetics, and food packaging. And the consequences of these exposures are profound and broad. They don't just span the things I experience in my pediatric practice, but they run the entire gamut of the life course. Everything from developmental disabilities and effects on developing brains of kids to obesity, diabetes, male and female reproductive consequences. And that's the sicker part. And the fatter really refers to the fact that there is a special, rapidly increasing body of evidence that suggests that chemicals can literally make us fatter. There's some 50 synthetic chemicals that just over the past couple decades have been recognized as obesogens, independent of diet and physical activity, which are so important. Nothing that I'm saying here undermines the importance of diet and physical activity as the major drivers of the obesity and diabetes epidemics we're seeing in the United States and across developed countries today. But increasingly, we're understanding that synthetic chemicals are an important and under-recognized third factor in that epidemic. So the prototype chemical obesogen is something called bisphenol A, or BPA. As I mentioned, it's used in aluminum cans and thermal paper receipts, and it makes fat cells bigger. It disrupts the function of a protein that protects the heart called adiponectin, and as a synthetic estrogen, it can have sex-specific effects on body mass, especially during vulnerable windows of development, such as puberty. So the reality is that there are multiple molecular mechanisms by which these chemicals can make us fatter. A group of chemicals that I haven't mentioned that's hit the scene recently are these forever chemicals, the perfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS. They make materials non-stick, and they contribute water and oil repellency to various products in our daily lives, including athletic wear.
Right, so they're not just in pots and pans, the so-called Teflon pans, but they're also in wrappers often, you know, so that things don't adhere to the wrapping, you know, because if it was just ordinary paper wrapping that's not chemically treated, maybe it would peel off so nicely.
Right. Imagine a piece of pizza you take from the pizzeria. It's in a box. The reason you don't literally have oil on your hands by the time you get home is that material is lined with this oil repellent material to keep the oil from dripping out of the box in the first place. And so these products are generally designed with reasonable intentions. They're designed for product benefits, but they haven't been properly tested in many cases for their consequences on the endocrine system. And we used to think that the dose made the proverbial poison, if you will, that lower levels of these exposures didn't matter. It's something akin to everything in moderation. But we now realize that the dose doesn't always make the poison. We know that chemicals, especially at very low doses of exposure, can have the biggest changes on the human body with respect to their functionality. And it's not unrealistic when you consider the fact that natural hormones occur in our body at very low levels, and they're designed
micromolecular levels. Just a few very, very tiny concentrations can cause profound changes, correct?
Right, and those are normal, natural hormones that our body produces on its own for basic molecular functions. And so the reality is that these chemicals should not surprise anyone as having their effects at these very low levels of exposure. It's also the reality that we have increasing evidence that chemicals can have effects that increase and then decrease, a little bit of the roller coaster ride, if you will. It's called non-monotonicity. It's something that makes people shiver in the usual toxicology community, but the reality is that you can have different switches, molecular switches in the body that shut things off and shut things down, and they affect people in different ways at lower and higher levels of exposure. And that's important because it makes the way we usually think about regulating these chemicals mm-hmm. go out the window.
Because they get tested, they're safety tested, and then they establish a threshold. They said, well, we don't see any problems below a certain level in a, you know, perhaps a healthy, robust population when we're testing these chemicals one by one singly, but maybe they have a synergy. 1 + 1 = 10.
Absolutely. And that's the complicating part when we think about policy decisions and how to regulate these exposures and decide if we would accept a small amount of an exposure in a product that gets into your food, for example, or absorbs into your body some other way. And that really is the theme that starts to shift us from sicker to fatter to poorer. So ultimately, these chemicals are used in products because it has value when those products are added. And there, unfortunately, are people who are hurt by these chemical exposures who don't participate in the sale or purchase of these materials in the first place. And that's really where the problem starts to come in. We've done a series of studies looking at only a few of the chemicals of concern and found that the cost of these exposures in the U.S. alone are $340 billion a year. That's 2.3% of our gross domestic product. Mm-hmm. And as I hinted at, these are based on only less than 5% of endocrine disrupting chemicals. Furthermore, they're based on a subset of diseases due to those same chemicals and a subset of costs due to those diseases, due to those few chemicals we studied. That means that this estimate is underestimating the actual total cost of endocrine disrupting chemicals. So when people bring up, well, it's too costly to replace one chemical to the other, there are real and substantial benefits, not only to human health, but to our economy by proactively interceding and preventing these exposures in the first place.
You know, and when I see poorer, I think of, you know, our economy in some ways is the haves and the have-nots. You know, there's, you know, a lot of wealth in America, but the distribution of wealth seems to be skewed towards, you know, ultra-wealthy individuals and people who are, you know, barely scraping by. But it seems to me that the burden of these environmental chemicals may be borne to a larger extent by poorer people because they can't shop at Whole Foods and get the, you know, organic natural products. Maybe also culturally, from an educational standpoint, they're less attuned to the hazards of environmental chemicals. They live in parts of the city that may be more polluted, and they're also the least capable of bearing the costs, the extraordinary medical costs of, say, a cancer diagnosis.
Well, the reality is that low-income minority populations have greater exposure to these chemicals, in part for the reasons that you described. We've done a series of studies suggesting that, indeed, racial and ethnic minorities, Hispanic and African-American populations predominantly, suffer the greatest burden of and costs as a result of these exposures. So it's a bit of double jeopardy. We usually think of healthcare access or other factors driving disparities in health. But the reality is that environmental factors are a major explanation of those disparities. Now, that doesn't mean that we should throw up our hands or lose hope, because a lot of the things that we can talk about with regard to preventing these exposures can be done by everyone. Mm-hmm. Nothing that I'm going to suggest
is not a luxury necessarily.
Yeah. Right. These are safe and simple steps that we can take, and it doesn't have to break the bank or require a PhD in chemistry.
You beautifully illustrate this phenomenon by contrasting a playground in 1962, you know, you take us back in time in your time machine to 1962 to watch kids playing on a playground, and then you contrast it to the present situation in 2019. That's a span of just over 50 years. What's changed, and can you describe that scenario?
We've had an increasing use of synthetic chemicals in that environment, and at the same time have seen a spike in multiple chronic conditions. Think about obesity and kids. There's been a tripling in the rates of childhood obesity. As a pediatric resident in the late 90s, I saw firsthand the influx of type 2 diabetes. We used to think of type 1 diabetes as a childhood disease, mm-hmm, yeah, and type 2 as the adult version.
We used to call it maturity onset diabetes because it was only adults who got it.
Yes. And now, unfortunately, we think of type 2 as something that crosses the age divide. It affects everyone. And that's because of the obesity epidemic, but also because of chemicals that disrupt basic metabolic functions. We've also seen increases in certain cancers. Endometriosis and fibroids are all too common. Not to mention the rates of developmental disabilities that affect too many children. And we're talking about things that don't just affect kids and moms, they affect adults and men and folks who are not trying to have families. We're talking about, in the case of the phthalates, chemicals that directly disrupt the male sex hormone, testosterone. Now, we think of that as something more for procreating or mm-hmm. for libido, but literally, low T is a marker for or predictor of adult cardiovascular disease, low T being low testosterone. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing is that this literally can be a life or death matter. If you have phthalates disrupting the function of the male sex hormone, you ultimately can connect the dots all the way to adult men having cardiovascular disease and stroke, to the tune of 10,000 U.S. men who die each year as a result of phthalate exposures, costing the economy $9 billion in lost economic productivity. So the story here is not just something for moms and kids to think about. It really affects all of us of all ages.
And what about the phenomenon of earlier and earlier puberty? Because, you know, if you go back to colonial records, you see that, girls wrote in their diaries and they would note that they had the onset of their first menstrual period at the age of 16, 17, sometimes 18. Nowadays, it's not uncommon to see 8-9-year-old girls developing secondary sex characteristics and beginning to menstruate. Early puberty, is that a sign that maybe we're exposed to too many gender-bending chemicals?
Well, it's a complicated story to interpret because there are many factors that have changed over that same time period. Diet, obesity being a factor that also has to be in the mix. And the reality is at the same time that synthetic chemicals can upregulate or downregulate male or female sex hormones. And when you have that change in regulation, it can set the stage for earlier or later puberty. Early puberty in young girls is a well-known risk factor for breast cancer. So this is not just something that affects timing of development. This can have long-term consequences reverberating for generation to come. And so these chemical exposures are tough to interpret, but they are part of the story when it comes to early puberty.
And when you're talking about developmental disorders, specifically you're talking about the higher incidence of autism, attention deficit disorder, bipolar disorder among kids. So that's and depression, anxiety, that's certainly soaring. There may be cultural factors. There may be dietary factors. But could chemicals be implicated in terms of brain function?
There's no doubt that there are many factors driving the increase in autism, among them being the trend in diagnosis that could be part of the story there. But it's hard to write away completely that entire story without considering environmental factors. And in studies that look at individual people, we find effects not just on the developing brains of kids in the form of cognitive potential, but in terms of the clinically significant autism and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. The reason behind that is that thyroid hormone is a key factor in brain development. It's really the growth factor of the developing brains of kids. Mm-hmm. And during pregnancy, the baby doesn't make thyroid hormone on his own until roughly the second trimester of pregnancy. And even in the clinically normal range, you can have subtle shifts in thyroid hormone function producing these long-term consequences in the form of autism, attention deficit, hyperactivity, and cognitive deficits. And we know that flame retardants and pesticides directly impair those functions. And there are multiple studies that have not just shown IQ test changes, but changes in magnetic resonance imaging and directly measured brains of these kids with matching effects. They're the parts of the brains that are disrupted that are the same as what you would expect with neuropsychological changes.
Mm-hmm. This became a term that's sort of a trash talk term, cretinism. You know, you're a cretin. You know, it's kind of an insult. But in medical school, we learned that that was the consequence of a mother being undiagnosed with hypothyroidism and then giving birth to a baby who has intellectual impairment and sort of gross features and enlarged tongue. So this can be induced chemically through blocking the action of thyroid hormones in the mother.
Yes. These chemicals can literally produce consequences that affect one kid at a time. But the reality is that a child comes back home with one less IQ point. Maybe mom or dad might not notice. The psychologist might not notice. The pediatrician might not notice. But if 100,000 kids come back with one less IQ point, the entire economy notices. Mm-hmm. We know that each IQ point is roughly worth a 2% change in a child's lifetime economic productivity. And if each kid makes about $1 million over her or his lifetime on average, 2% of $1 million is $20,000.
Hence poorer.
And then you multiply that.
It's about the GNP, the gross national product.
Exactly. And you have 4 million kids born each year. That means you have a lot of zeros on the right side of the equation as a result. And so that is a big driver of these large economic consequences that we see as a result of endocrine disrupting chemicals. And in that regard, there's something important to emphasize we haven't talked as much about, which is that policy predicts exposure. Exposure contributes to disease, and disease ultimately costs us all. In the U.S., we've had a legacy where we've added flame retardants to every conceivable piece of furniture from the 1970s until about 2015.
In a misguided effort to protect children from fire hazards, yeah?
That's right. And California did it. Liberal California was the state that implemented this regulation with good intentions. But we've had a legacy where we have had the highest levels of flame retardants in the U.S. population compared to any other country in the world.
Mm-hmm. And this is not just, we measure in the blood, in the urine, in the breast milk. We see those levels. They're not just, in the clothing or the furniture, but actually they get absorbed.
That's right. And ultimately impair the thyroid hormone functioning in the brains of these kids. And Europe regulated these chemicals much more proactively. They never required them to be added. So Europeans have much lower levels. And the cost of flame retardant exposures in the U.S. is roughly $240 billion a year. In Europe, it's about $9 billion a year. And the only good news for the U.S. is that the opposite is the story for pesticides. We, through the Food Quality Protection Act, required an additional safety factor be added for this category of chemicals used in agriculture to protect kids. And as a result, we haven't used as much organophosphate pesticide, even though organic has not been as popular in the U.S. compared to Europe. That means that Europeans have had higher levels of these exposures. And so the costs in Europe are $121 billion. The costs in the U.S. are $47 billion. So again, this goes back to policy predicting exposure, exposure contributing to disease, and disease ultimately affecting us all.
Okay. Well, we've laid the groundwork for our discussion in part two. And in part two, I want to talk more. We pointed out many of the hazards. We can extend our discussion about that, but I also want to focus on solutions. You know, what can we do individually? What can we do as voters and as concerned citizens to stem the tide of environmental pollutants that and deliberately added ingredients in foods and in produce that make us sicker, fatter, and poorer? That's the title of a book by today's guest. He's Dr. Leo Trasandy. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.